is made possible in part by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Today we take a look at the business of news. Journalist and media critic Ken Oletta of The New Yorker is our guest. His latest book is Backstory, Inside the Business of News. Ken Oletta says the debate over whether the media have a liberal or conservative bias should take a back seat to another debate. He says the real bias in news is an economic bias and a bias for conflict. In the introduction to his book, Oletta confesses that he's a sucker for the romance of journalism, but he says the successes of journalism, the stories of the civil rights movement, Vietnam and Watergate, have induced excess. Reporters, he says, wanted to be famous, rich, influential. He continues, as a media writer, I've reported on a new generation of windbags, of callow people, who think they become investigative reporters by adopting a belligerent pose without doing the hard digging, of bloviators so infatuated with their own voice they have forgotten how to listen, of news presidents who are slaves to ratings, and of editors terrified they may bore readers. As in any profession, some folks take shortcuts. The shortcut I worry about most today falls under the rubric of business pressures. Listeners, I invite you to join the discussion with your questions and comments. Join us with a telephone call in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Ken Oletta has written the Annals of Communication column and profiles for The New Yorker since 1992. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Ken Oletta, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
My pleasure.
There are some buzzwords out there that come up often when media are discussed. They include synergy and borderless. Would you tell us what these words mean?
Well, I'll tell you what it means to the people who mouth the platitude. To business people, when they speak of synergy, they mean the new math, which is 1 plus 1 equals 4. And what they mean by that is that if we merge our company with these other companies, which is the argument that Comcast is making for merging with Disney today, or that that Viacom made for merging with CBS, or old AOL and Time Warner, et cetera. But the urge to merge that we see particularly acutely in the media world is one that believes that if we get these companies together, the whole will be greater than the sum of the parts, and that we can get one division to promote the other divisions, and therefore, if we have an entertainment division and a news division, we could put people from and shows from our entertainment division on Today's Show or Good Morning America, and use it as a kind of a promotional platform. That's synergy of a sort, and that's the kind of synergy they talk about. Or if we own an entertainment entity, a network, let us say, we could produce in our factory, our studio factory, the shows, and assure that we put our own shows on the air, and therefore keep them on the air for a long period of time, and therefore sell them in syndication, again, increasing the value. Yeah. That's the belief. That's what synergy is about. Synergy is also about cost-cutting, that if we combine two companies, we can combine the financial functions of both companies into one and save and do some cost savings, too.
Yeah, and borderlessness refers to there being no walls within an organization.
Well, it means that what you do is borderless is often used in conjunction with the word teamwork, and what it means is we get the team, people to think as a team and work together and reduce the barriers between divisions. We go on retreats, our company, and get people to talk to each other, and out of that fermentation, that talking that they do, we will come up with ideas, and we'll figure out how each division can help the other. Now, that in the abstract makes sense, and often does make sense in the business sense, but for journalists, it's often a menace, because when we think about a borderless company, we think, my God, they want to put the ad salespeople in the newsroom. which is exactly what we don't want. We want a high wall between the ad salespeople and the news people, because we don't want people from ad sales coming in saying, God, if you only did a story about a nice story about this restaurant or this company, we get more ads. Mm. Exactly what you don't want, because it would undermine the credibility of journalists.
Yeah. A piece you wrote for The New Yorker that was published in May of 98, titled Synergy City, features the Tribune Company, and you wrote in that piece, at Tribune, synergy is mantra. How does it work at the Tribune Company?
Well, what the Tribune does, and they were one of the early adapters of this notion, they said, look, what we have to do is, why can't we own not just a newspaper, but we can own a radio station, which they do in Chicago, as you know, and we could start a local cable news operation, which they did in Chicago, and they could own a sports team, which they do in Chicago, and they can create an online website. And why don't we put them all in the, except for the sports team, put them in the a representative in the newsroom at the Chicago Tribune, and have them work together and see how we can create synergy between them. So if we have a restaurant reviewer for the newspaper, why can't that restaurant reviewer also do spots on our radio station, and why can't that restaurant reviewer also do spots on our local cable TV shows? And they have taken that model in Chicago and applied it to many of their other papers in cities around the country. And so that is Synergy City, and that is a place where they say that, my God, we're increasing the value of our paper, and we're getting our reporters to work harder. Now, oftentimes reporters complain they don't get paid enough extra to do this stuff.
Yeah.
But I even had the oddity of the editor of Chicago Tribune, the then editor, not the current editor, say to me that he considered himself to be a content provider. He didn't consider himself to be the editor of the newspaper, and he was a good editor. But he bought into this new business religion of being a content provider.
Hmm. What is the difference between content and news?
There may not be any difference, but if the danger is that you see yourself as a team player, and you say to yourself, I am not just concerned about news, I am concerned about how do I advance the brand of the Tribune Company. And how do I help my friends or colleagues in the advertising sales department? Or how do we get our circulation up in these suburban areas? And when you start thinking that way, there is a danger. Now, obviously, if you're a news editor, you have to think about how do I increase circulation and business. If you don't, you're not a very smart editor or a good editor, and you'll be fired. But on the other hand, you don't want that to be a preoccupation, because if it becomes a preoccupation, what you get is the equivalent of what you get in television, which is people who are totally preoccupied with ratings.
Yeah.
And therefore with the business questions and not the news questions.
There's a stunning story you tell in the introduction to Backstory. It's about a CBS News executive who was on board the corporate team big time as she tried to get Jessica Lynch to the Tiffany Network.
Yes.
You want to tell us that story?
Well, she wrote a letter to, it was a senior vice president at CBS, and she wrote a letter to Jessica Lynch's representatives in which she said, if you cooperate with us, we could do it, the Jessica Lynch story, we can do it on CBS and have you on our various CBS news shows and magazine shows, but we could also put in a plug and work with our colleagues in the entertainment division to do a Jessica Lynch special movie. And we could work with our colleagues at MTV, which is also part of the Viacom CBS enterprise, and get you involved there. But we can take our various divisions, be it in cable or in entertainment or in film or in news or in entertainment at the network, and we could create that kind of synergy and really help you and promote your book.
Outside of the vertical integration.
By the way, she was not the only one. This was a proposal, a pitch made to Jessica Lynch by, among others, the News Corp and NBC and others. So CBS was hardly alone in making that pitch.
Right. It seems that there are, you know, the CBS News executive and others like her had at their disposal all these resources of a company to, you know, try to lure a story into their organization, And outside of that, is the story different today from how the news business, the business side of the newspaper, works from the way it was 20, 30, 50, or 100 years ago?
Oh, of course it is. It's and that's not to suggest it was perfect or the golden days 15, 20, 30 years ago, but it is to suggest that that as we move towards media concentration, as fewer companies own many more newspapers, radio stations, TV stations, networks, et cetera, and they become these giant companies, increasingly the business pressures in those companies, they are professionally managed companies, and they're companies that are preoccupied with their stock price, with their profit margin, with the things that, that good businessmen and women are concerned with. But increasingly what happens in that in these giant companies is that the news side, the news division, become a smaller and smaller part of a larger and larger company, and a less productive part. The news division is not the part that is going to produce your big, healthy profit margin. They are produced in your other divisions, you know, your non-news divisions. So the pressure on news to perform, to compete with the other divisions, to keep up with the Joneses, if you will, becomes much more intense in these companies. And so the pressure on the news people is to think more about ratings, to think more about how do you, how do we not bore our readers or viewers, or how do we produce news you can use? How do we produce softer news that attracts more women and younger readers or viewers? And those questions are not necessarily journalistic questions.
Yeah. How many news outlets are using focus groups to determine what the content will be that they'll offer?
Well, you see, you don't have to. All you need to do is know, which there's plenty of research to tell people this, the answer to this. What is it that younger people or women like? Well, we know what they like. I mean, one of the reasons you see so many crime stories on local television is because younger people tend to be more interested in that. And one of the reasons you see more health stories and mammogram stories and diet stories and weather stories is because younger people will tend to be more attracted to that, and older people tend to be more attracted to things like international news and in a way more serious news. And that is a division that is very well known. And so one of the reasons you see what might be called a softening of the news or less hard news, both in television and oftentimes in newspapers, is this drive to attract people who are not your intense viewers or readers and who are younger and therefore more appealing to advertisers.
Yeah. I've got a listener who wants to join the conversation, and I want to get to his or her call in just a second here. But before I do that, I want to follow up here. What are your thoughts about how news media on the Internet are affecting the news business? And one of the things I've kind of wondered about is, you know, you'll go to, let's say you go to the Washington Post website, and you can click on top 20 most emailed articles. Is the Internet having an impact on editorial decisions?
Oh, absolutely. I tell a story in my book about campaign coverage and how it's changed. And one of the ways it's changed is that if you're on the campaign trail as reported today, it used to be that you would at the end of the day, there would be space provided by the candidates in a room with typewriters or you'd take your laptop computer in 10 years ago. And you'd file your story. You'd talk to your editor, and you'd file your story. And your editor would be in the dark, and you would tell him or her what you thought the story was that day. Today, you call your editor or in touch with your editor by email. By the way, it's wireless now, Wi-Fi. You can use your cell phone and just connect right into your laptop on the bus or on a train or a plane. And you can communicate with your editor, and you say to your editor, I think the story is as follows, and your editor says, wait a second, I don't think that's the story today. I've already seen that on the blogger or on the web, or I've seen it on Fox News or CNN or MSNBC. You need another lead. You need another story. So what happens is that it used to be that you were dealing with one news cycle a day, one story a day. And now you're dealing with multiple news cycles. So constantly, because of technology, and the web and cable television networks that didn't exist 10 years ago. CNN did, but the others didn't. And the web certainly didn't, in the sense it exists today. What you have is this constant feeding of new information, and therefore speeding up of information, and therefore putting more pressure on reporters to do stories. By the way, that contributes to the conflict-oriented press, and it means that reporters have less time to report, to get the facts right, and to create, and to get the context. Mm.
So editors are now ordering up stories like hot dogs and fries.
They do, and the other thing that happens is that you get a situation, as happened a couple weeks ago with Matt Drudge. He puts on his website a rumor about John Kerry and allegedly having an affair. And then the press has to make instantaneous decisions. And by the way, I think they made the right decisions to refrain from going with a story that was just a rumor and actually proved to be a false rumor. Hmm. But it creates more pressure on the rest of the press to decide, are we going to go with the story or are we not?
Let's talk with some listeners. First, we're going to talk with a listener in Eureka, Illinois. Line 4, go ahead.
Thank you. May I ask two questions, please?
Sure.
First of all, I wonder what your opinion is of this Clear Channel Company, which I believe owns 1,200 radio stations. I think Bill Moyers has discussed and evaluated in his program now.
I think they do own over 1,200 stations, and that's too many. And I think that one of the... They had, at the time of the 1996 Telecommunications Act, Clear Channel owned just a couple hundred radio stations. But that act allowed them, deregulated radio, and allowed them to increase. So you go to some communities where they'll own four or five stations in a single city.
Do you know who is behind the persons who is behind it?
The gentleman who's the CEO, I'm blocking his name right now, but... there is a CEO. He's been there for a very long time, and obviously he's been successful. If you consider building 1,200 stations a success, but the question is that too much concentration of power? And that's a question that we have about the media in general. Mm. I mean, it's a question that people are going to be asking about the proposed acquisition by Comcast of Disney.
That goes to my next one. Does the Clear Channel pattern usually mean? They just have like
his name is Mays.
Mays. Oh, thank you. Do they usually take away most of the what they call localism, and they just go to sort of a generic pipe satellite fed music broadcast?
There are three dangers with that kind of concentration of power. One is that it means that you move away from local ownership, and initially. In the Radio Act of 1912 and then the Broadcasting Act of 1927, enshrined in those laws is this notion that you're supposed to have, that a goal of give, when we give away the public airways, which they are, we're just renting the airways to these companies. They're public, it's public property, we're renting them. In return, they're supposed to have some concern about localism. And when you have 1,200 stations and you run them centrally and the news divisions and the music is done in order to save costs more centrally, then obviously you take away from localism. Second thing you're supposed to do is have diversity of voices. And obviously if you have the fewer owners you have, the less diverse of voices you have. And the third concern is concentration of ownership. Is it too concentrated where you just have a handful of giant companies that in effect are divvying up the pot and which affects localism and affects diversity, but also potentially gives them enormous leverage over advertisers, program suppliers, etc.
Could you briefly discuss, and I'll take the answer off the air, is it Comcast?
Comcast.
Disney's going to merge with. Thank you
very
much, sir.
It's a proposal that Comcast has made. Whether it'll happen, we don't know. But Comcast is today the largest cable systems owner in the United States. They own 21 million cable boxes. They are the largest supplier of cable boxes. The second largest is Time Warner.
Let's talk with another listener. Caller on line 1. Good afternoon.
Yeah, hi.
Hi.
I wanted to remind you, and that's all, and possibly you could add some additional information. Your earlier book, The Three Blind Mice, talked about the conglomeration of, or the purchase of the three networks by other forces, that is NBC by GE and ABC by Disney and so on, and that as soon as they took over these networks, essentially at about the same time, they cut the staffs of their news operations in half, approximately. And, of course, where they hadn't been really complete news organizations before, they had been fairly decent, and since then, they're not worth very much.
In that book, which came out in 1991, which covered the period from 1985 to 1991, I did show how the professional management, as it was called, of the three networks by three new owners, one of the things they did do was to try and get control of costs, and they went after the news costs, hacking away at them. They didn't cut half the news staff, it wasn't that much, but they did cut substantially, and obviously cut a lot of foreign bureaus. So if you went back and looked at the newscast on ABC, CBS, and NBC in, let's say, 1985, and compared it with that newscast today, among the things you would see different, back then you would see that the average newscast was about 23 minutes of news and about 7 minutes of commercials. Today it's 18 minutes of news and about 12 minutes of commercials, sometimes 12 and a half minutes of commercials. You would see much more music today than you saw then. You would see less international news today than you saw then. You would see fewer overseas bureaus than you saw then. You would see less government news today than you saw then. And you would see much more news of health and women-related issues and other things. So it in this drive to attract younger viewers who are more attractive to advertising.
Is it just a drive to attract younger viewers, or is it...
And save costs.
Or is it something much more devious, that is to control the economics of the country, basically?
No, I tend not to be I'm not saying that it never happens, but and clearly I can cite, as you can, examples where it has happened, but I tend not to be a conspiratorialist. I don't believe that Jack Welch, who is the head of GE over NBC, was treating them like a puppet in order to advance his political agenda.
Just out for the profits.
I think these people, if you can make a profit doing liberal programming, they do it in a minute.
Oh, okay, thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon, that listener in Chicago. Thanks for the call. Next, we're going to talk with a caller who's waiting for us in Urbana on line two. Hi.
Yeah, hi. I have two questions. One has to do with the common idea that a lot of this problem has to do with the Eastern establishment, that it's too incestuous and there's too much crony capitalism going on over there and everybody's watching each other's backs too much, and then therefore there's never any kind of interest in developing any kind of resolving power, and they just wallow in fruitless wheel spinning, et cetera, et cetera. What's your take on that take?
I mean, I think there is some back scratching that goes on in any field, be it in the media in this case, or the publishing world, or the software world. But having said that, and you know, there'll be things where if you have an awards presentation on your show this year, the Emmy Awards this year, and it's going to go next year to another network, you tend not to program your best stuff against them because you don't want them to program their best stuff against you next year. So there is a little bit of that, which you might call back scratching. But essentially, these people would kill each other if they could, and they're very competitive, and they don't want anything to get in the way of winning. Now, what happens is that oftentimes they find that a person who is your competitor in one field is your supplier in another. That is to say, if Rupert Murdoch, who owns Fox, now owns DirecTV, which is the largest satellite provider in the country, right? And so he's a competitor of ABC, and he's a competitor of Paramount Studios, his Fox Studios. 20th Century Fox competes with Paramount. On the other hand, Paramount supplies him movies for his DirecTV, and it supplies him movies for his overseas satellite distribution. So Paramount or ABC are both competitors of his, but they're also suppliers of his. So, and that automatically reins in your behavior. And so what you wind up doing is the back scratching becomes part of it. Or in a way, if you compared it to our former relationship with the Soviet Union, it becomes a form of mutually assured destruction. That is to say, you know that if you drop the bomb on them, they're going to drop the bomb on you. So you don't drop the bomb on them. You compete with them, and you want to hurt them, and you want to beat them, but you don't want to destroy them because you know they can destroy you.
No, I don't really buy that.
You don't? Why? What do you?
Well, because, for example, you said that teamwork is widespread nowadays
within a company.
Well, at any rate, if you know, look at the science industry, where one experiment can disprove a theory, and it's enough to turn everyone's head around. The entire canon is up for grabs constantly, needing only proof to displace it. And that kind of mentality could very well work in the media, but it's not there because. There's too much all graduated from the same Ivy League school and all this junk, I think.
Nah.
Let me ask you another question.
Go ahead.
Okay.
I would dispute that. Rupert Murdoch didn't go to that same Ivy League school as Brian Roberts of Comcast.
Yeah, but I guarantee you he's filling up his managers and executive offices with those people. A lot of people say that I've read studies that say students go into journalism classes, and many of them are more interested in getting into public relations than journalism. And I think they've got the right idea there. Probably pays more. And even if they have to take a job in journalism as a second choice, they are engaged in public relations anyway. What's your take on that? I'll hang up and listen.
There are a couple of journalism schools that don't allow you the teaching or don't allow students to attend the journalism school who are also studying public relations. One is Berkeley and the other is Columbia Journalism School. Some other journalism schools, many other journalism schools, teach them jointly, teach marketing and public relations and journalism as one whole part of the journalism school. I actually agree with Berkeley and Columbia Day School. I think they're different fields and different professions. I'm not knocking public relations, but it's not the same business as journalism. Mm. In public relations, you're selling. In journalism, you're buying. Mm. Very different profession.
Journalist and media critic Ken Auletta of The New Yorker is our guest this afternoon. His latest book is Backstory, Inside the Business of News. Ken Auletta has written the Annals of Communication column and profiles for The New Yorker since 1992. In addition to Backstory, Inside the Business of News, he is the author of 8 books. His book, Backstory, published by the Penguin Press. This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. I'm Celeste Quinn. Listeners, if you'd like to join us with questions, comments, give us a call. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll free, 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Let's follow up on the last comment that the listener made, the caller in Urbana. Journalism, you write in this book, in one of the pieces that you did, is not a walk-on profession. I believe this was in the introduction to the book. Uh-huh. Is the training that aspiring journalists receive today adequate?
Probably not, which is why in that introduction to the book I write about the process we went through at Columbia Journalism School, where the incoming president of Columbia came in and he said, I want to stop the search for a new dean. And before I pick a new dean, his name is Lee Bollinger, who's the new president of Columbia. He said, before I pick a new dean, I want to analyze what do I want out of a journalism education, and should I change the nature of the school? And after I make a decision about what the nature of journalism education is, then I want to go look for a dean. And so he picked a task force of over 30 people, many from journalists and different, be it television, online, print, radio, and he asked us to attend a series of 6 evening dinners where we sat around and talked about these issues, and papers were done, and debate took place. And out of that came a proposal, in fact, to experiment with a two-year rather than a one-year journalism education, in which you expand the nature of what is taught. And out of that came a new dean for the Columbia Journalism School, a member of the task force, Nicholas Lemon, who was a colleague of mine at The New Yorker. And I think that was a very creative process that was gone through. But having said that, I don't believe, as someone who didn't go to journalism school myself, I don't believe you have to go to journalism school to be a journalist. But I do think you have to go through a period of training, be it in journalism school or on-the-job training, where you are subjected to some rigorous tests and pressures, including, you know, not just the basic who, what, when, where, why of a story that you're supposed to get down and how to write a lead, but how to check facts and how to provide context. I think there's training to be done if you want to be called a professional.
Hmm. One of the things you also talk about in the introduction is the importance of humility. Can it be taught?
You can teach it. I mean, you make enough mistakes and you get enough kicks in the rear end, you're going to learn some humility.
Sure.
From that. And if you get enough criticism, there's enough media critics out there, and I hope there are more, you may learn a little humility from that. And one of the things happening in the online world is that increasingly, which is a wonderful thing, I think, increasingly, the reporters on the campaign trail pick up and go online in the morning and they see critiques of their work. And that's healthy. Now, if the critique, particularly if the critiques are correct and factually correct, but I think all of that is very good. But I think essentially it's a human quality you have or you don't have. But I think an editor can help instill that in you. And I have a story in the book about McClanlish Phillips, who was arguably the best writer on the New York Times 25 or so years ago, and I go through how he reported stories and. He basically loved asking questions and listening to the answers. Mm. And increasingly, the journalistic community today is a community, when I use the word bloviated, which you quoted before,
mm-hmm.
is a community of people who spend too much time on television shows announcing their opinions and not sitting back and listening. Our job, a good journalist's job, is to be a good listener. And to be a good listener, you've got to have some humility. Otherwise, you fill the void with your own noise, which is not what you're supposed to do. But McClanlish Phillips was a guy who listened and then wrote beautifully, and then at some point decided that he'd become a born-again Christian. He decided that he wanted to leave the Times in order to pursue his new love, which was Jesus Christ. I found him up by Columbia University handing out Bibles and speaking to people on street corners. And he's a happy man. But when he was a journalist, he was a humble man. He's still a humble man, by the way.
Hmm.
And I think humility is a key ingredient. And when you go on these television shows and make these speeches and become stars, it's very hard to keep the humility.
Hmm. Let's talk with another listener. Caller in Champaign County, line one.
Hi.
Hi.
I was struck by this business about the bloviating and this image of the sort of the swaggering journalist, and I think I'm more persuaded now that you mention it in the context of punditry. But it seems to me that you know, this is sort of this critique I've heard for a long time, that after Watergate, you know, everybody was going to J school and wanting to do this, but it seems like there's such a institutional restraint and self-censorship, it seems, in the corporate press that, you know, it's you're sort of, you can't really swagger, so maybe they make up for it in bloviating, I suppose. But I had one thing specific to ask about, and on another call-in show on this station, and I can't, it's a bit of hearsay, but a guy who's written a major book study of the Enron scandal, said that off the record, he talked to the New York Times business reporter on the beat, and he actually said, and you know, according to this fellow, and no reason particularly, that the news reporter suggested that the whole thing was a trial of skilling, was a waste of prosecutorial time, that he didn't take it seriously, and that seems to be a important indicator of what I think you've called the the other thing that you were talking, you were speaking about, the idea that it's not necessarily class, but money has a lot to do with what kind of coverage there is. So this is a particular instance of the general notion, it seems to me.
I don't know whether the Times Report actually said that.
I don't either, but I.
But the Times has had pretty aggressive coverage of Enron.
Yeah.
I mean, I think you have to concede that, and I think the press in general has been pretty aggressive about Enron. But Enron, if I said to you that it is not easy to prove, it is not as easy as we'd like it to be to prove a case, a legal case in a courtroom against, say, Skilling. I mean, I've heard reporters who think that Skilling and Enron were an outrage say that. I saw it on the Charlie Rose show the other night, a group of Enron reporters say that. So, I mean, there is an argument that is same in the Martha Stewart case. You might think someone did something wrong, but proving that they did something illegal may be a different threshold.
Well, I think the scandal about Enron, to some extent, and a lot of corporate scandals are not what's illegal, but what's, you know, what isn't illegal and what's unethical. And I actually beg to differ about Enron. There are a lot of international dimensions of the Enron scandal that I don't think are getting adequate, particularly the nexus of the political. I mean, we hear the quote that, you know, Enron was the biggest contributor to Bush's campaign funding throughout his whole career. But
well, he's been on Kenboy.
Yeah, but you don't hear the kind of things that they did for them, which they did do. And even under the Clinton administration, there were these favors done in the international realm that aren't talked about. And, you know, the other thing about Enron is that in California, one hears talk about, the $9 billion that should be recouped from someone because it was product of gaming, but it doesn't come up that terribly often, it seems to me. So I think there actually is a lot of backstory on Enron that doesn't actually get treated as much as it should. So anyway,
well, your argument is that the backstory is the press is often not tough enough. And am I reading?
I guess that's one thing you could pull out of that. Yeah,
right.
Yeah. But they're covering the trial now and they're covering the implications and that. But are they really digging in? And
did you read any of the Enron books?
The book this fellow wrote.
The book in particular I'm thinking about is a book by the Fortune reporters.
Ah, no, I haven't. This was a Texan guy.
Yeah, this is a guy who used to work for, I think, the Dallas Morning News.
Yeah, but the one I think is probably the class of the field is this. It's called The Smartest Guys in the Room, The Amazing Rise and Scandalous Fall of Enron, and it's by Bethany McLean and Peter Elkin, and they're the Fortune reporters.
Oh, okay.
That's a pretty tough book.
Yeah, I think it might have been Elkin who was on the morning talk program here that the caller was referring
right.
to. Right. Let's go back to synergism before we run out of time here. It's something that is desired on the corporate side, but hopefully antagonism may better describe how journalists work or should work. You know, comfort the afflicted, afflict
right.
the comfortable. Yet you say in the book, since, you know, it's the executives who write the checks, somehow journalists have to persuade the corporate chiefs to broaden their too narrow definition of success. What might a broader definition of success contain, and are journalists and news executives ready for this discussion?
Well, I think we have to learn, we meaning journalists, have to learn a different lingo, a language. One of the interesting problems and challenges before us is that there is a cultural chasm that exists between the business culture that signs out checks and the journalistic culture. And the business people talk about synergy, and when journalists hear synergy, we think shilling. They want us to shill for the company. And the corporation talks about cost cutting and profit margins, and when we hear that, we hear that they want to cut news expenditures. And the corporate speak is to talk about teamwork and lowering the walls between divisions. And we think of we don't think of teamwork first. We think of an adversarial system or independence, which is what journalism is supposed to have. So we have a different value system. Then the question is, how do you narrow that gap? And one way to narrow that gap, and it's, obviously it's going to be very hard, is that what the business people talk about is brand all the time. They say we have to extend the brand. The brand is everything. And what does brand mean? Well, in journalistic terms, what brand means is credibility. And if we don't have credibility journalistically, then the brand is worthless. Somehow, we have to be able to communicate to the business people who sign the checks that when they talk about brand, they're talking about credibility. And when they talk about credibility, if you cut overseas bureaus and soften the news too much, or you really insist on doubling the profit margin, that if you do that, we have to quantify for them what doubling the profit margin would mean. How many bureaus do we have to close to do that? How many awards do we not enter because we don't have the investigative staff to undertake the projects anymore? And when you do that, and when you show the bosses, if you will, that we're going to have to curb the kind of journalism that makes them proud around awards time, then maybe you can get through to them. And at least that's the hope.
Yeah. What do the ratings of news shows and circulation figures for newspapers and news magazines look like today?
Down in general?
Yeah.
Obviously, and part of the reason for that is there are two real large reasons for it. One is that people have so many more choices today. I mean, think about the 500-channel or 1,000-channel universe. And think about the Internet. And think about Game Boys. And think about personal digital assistants. Think about all the diversions or iPods that we have that compete for our attention. So inevitably, viewing on not only network, on broadcast stations and networks, but also on cable networks is down because of all these choices that you have. But in addition to that, I mean, I think people are reading less. And that's one of the reasons that help account, as does competition, for why newspaper readership since in the post-war period, I'm talking about post-World War II, has been in a steady decline. Now, there's some magazines. My magazine, for instance, The New Yorker, is actually growing in circulation. It's up to 1 million now. But and some other magazines have grown. Vanity Fair's circulation grew. Some others have grown. But in general, the trend in print and television is in decline for the reasons I gave.
Yeah. You know, I know people who say almost proudly they don't subscribe to a newspaper or read the paper, and their news they get from The Daily Show.
Well, one of the things that terrifies editors and the business people who own these media companies is, particularly print, is that younger people are reading less. And therefore, the worry is that in the future they won't be reading newspapers, and that's a menace to both the business menace to these media companies, but also a menace to journalism.
Hmm.
So, and can we turn that around?
Hmm.
I don't know. I mean, I watch my daughter, who multitasks. I mean, she reads a newspaper while she watches television, while she listens to music, while she's on her email. And I say, how do you do all those four things? I only do one thing at a time. But kids do, but the question is, will they read the papers, the newspapers, the way, or magazines, the way their parents did? And that's a question mark.
Hmm. Well, besides
survey research says they're not, and that's worrisome.
Yeah. Besides the New Yorker, what are the bright lights in journalism today?
Oh, there are lots. I mean, I love The Economist, I love the Financial Times, I love the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, the LA Times, the Chicago Tribune is a good newspaper. There are a lot of great journalists, and there are good journalists who could do a better job if they didn't have the pressure to write every day and report every day and would give them more space. I mean, the great enemy of, among the many enemies of good journalism is lack of time. And that's the luxury someone like me has in writing this book. Mm-hmm. I have time. But a lot of daily journalists don't have the time and have less time today because of things like the Internet and how it speeds up news. But there are a lot of good journalists out there, and it's a great... I mean, the idea of being a journalist in a democracy is fundamentally important. It's really the, and it's why we have the protection of the First Amendment. The presumption of the Founding Fathers was that in order for democracy to function, people need good independent information to make intelligent choices. And that's our job. And that's a big responsibility. And it's an exciting responsibility. Mm. So it is a kind of a public calling, if you will. And I know a lot of journalists who wake up in the morning thinking they're performing a public service.
Mm.
But increasingly, my worry is that that too much of journalism doesn't perform a public service. It performs this function of conflict and titillation and Michael Jackson reporting and Martha Stewart reporting, and which is excessive.
Yeah. One more thing I want to ask you about before we've got to wrap up here, and it's got to be quick. This weekend, one of the Sunday news shows on television, I think it was on cable, a reporter said the media hasn't paid enough attention to John Edwards, in part at least because there hasn't been enough conflict there. What do you think? That this reporter was actually saying the media could have hurt his campaign by not reporting on him.
I don't agree with that.
Okay.
I think John Edwards has gotten a pretty free ride so far. I mean, I think he obviously comes off as an attractive guy. He's a smart guy, but he's gotten a lot of attention. He got a lot of attention after Wisconsin, a state he lost by 6%, and he was hailed as almost as if he had won the state. So I think the press is biased, not for conflict in this case. Actually, for conflict, it's helped him, because our bias is for keeping the contest going. And it's an unconscious bias, and that has kept him alive.
Yeah. You got to have a story.
All right.
Thanks so much for talking with us this
My
afternoon.
Pleasure.
Ken Auletta is a journalist. He's a media critic. He writes for The New Yorker. He has written the Annals of Communication column and profiles for The New Yorker since 1992. In addition to his latest book, Backstory Inside the Business of News, he is the author of 8 books, this latest Backstory, published by the Penguin Press. 7 minutes before 2 o'clock Central Time, settlement prices in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason.
Thanks very much. This afternoon at the Board of Trade, another big day there, where corn futures managed in the July contract to reach 6.5-year highs. Not only that, but the July's jumped through the $3 hoop. So now we have $9 beans, and we do have at least one contract of corn that is trading in the $3 level. Let's take a look at how things settled at the board. March futures in the wheat pit at 394.5, high low at 387.5, a settlement price there at 392.5. They were up 1.5 for the day. May contract 402, the high, the low at 395, a settlement price at 398.5, up 0.5. And July futures 397.5 on the high, low at 391, settled 396.5, a penny and 3/4 higher. September wheat, 399.5, the high, the low at 394. Settlement price at 398. They finished 1 higher. December futures, 406.5 on the high, the low at $4 even. Settled 406, up 2. From the corn pit, 291, the high for the nearby March contract, and the low at 285. A settlement price there, 290.75, up 3.5 cents. May corn, 298, the high, the low at 291.75. Settled 297.75, up 3.75. July futures, $3.5, the high, low at 294.5, a settlement price there above $3, $3.25 for the settlement price for that July corn contract, 3.75 higher. We'll discuss the corn market, by the way, with Wayne Nelson of L&M Commodities in Newmarket, Indiana, this afternoon during the closing market report, and then we'll take a special look at that corn market with agricultural economist from the University of Illinois, Daryl Good. That all coming up during the closing market report at 6 after the hour, 2 o'clock. September corn, 295, the high, the low at 288.5, a settlement price at 294.5, up 3.75. The December contract, 292.5 on the high, the low at 285.5. Settlement, 292.25, up 4 cents. March futures, 294.25, the high, the low at 288. Settlement, 294, up 3.5. And the July futures, 295.5, high, low at 291. Next year's July, 295, up 3. And December of the 05 contract, 263.5, the high, the low at 259.5. Settlement, 262.5, up 3.5. March oats, 152.25, the high, the low at 150.5. A settlement at 151.75, up 0.5 cent for the day. From the soy complex, March beans, 931, the high, the low at $9.02, settled $9.29 of a cent, up 18.25 for the day. May beans, 927, the high, the low at 898, a settlement at 926, up 19. And July futures, 908.5, the high, the low 883, settled 907.5, up 19.5. September, $8, the even, trade for the day for the September. 774, the high, the low, or the low, and the settlement price at 797, up 21 against the September's, had a high of $8, a low at 774, and a settlement at 797, up 21 cents. November beans, 729, the high, the low at 698, settlement price at 727, they were up 22 cents. I think that takes them up about 55 cents for this week. January beans, 728, the high, the low at 702, settlement price at 726.5, up 22.5 cents, and the March being 727, the high, the low at 711, settled 727, they were up 23. March bean meal at 280.50, the high, the low at 272, settlement price at 280.30, up 560, and the March oil at 34.13 on the high, the low at 33.15, a settlement at 34.10, they finished 44 higher. Now here's Celeste with the numbers from the Mercantile Exchange.
Thanks, Todd. Higher day today for cattle, lower day for hogs and bellies. March feeder cattle, 85.95, the high, 84.10, the low, 85.75, the settlement, that up 185. April, 85.25, the high, 83.60, the low, 84.80, the settlement, that up 150. May, 85.87.5, the high, 84.50, the low, 85.82.5, the settlement, that up 147.5. August feeder cattle, 88 even, the high, 87.30, the low, 88 even, the settlement, that up 70. February live cattle, 80.30, the high, 78.85, the low, the settlement, 80.22.5, that up 165. March, 77.20, the high, 76 even, the low, 77.20, the settlement, that up 210. April, 75.80, the high, 73.80, the low, finishing at 75.62.5, up 200. June, 72.10, the high, 70.35, the low, 71.85, the settlement, that up 147.5. April lean hog, 61.67.5, the high, 60.55, the low, the settlement, 60.97.5, that down 5. May, 61.25, the high, 60.85, the low, the settlement, 61.20, that down 7.5. June lean hogs unchanged today, 65.35, the high, 64.50, the low, 65.17.5, the settlement, unchanged. July, 61.95, the high, 61.40, the low, 61.90, the settlement, that down 12.5. February pork bellies, 97.50, the high, 94.90, the low, 94.90, the settlement, that down 130. And March bellies, 97.65, the high, 96, even, the low, the settlement, 96.15, that down 5. The Dow currently down 69 points at 10,540. The NASDAQ 8 lower at 1999. The S&P 500 off 5 points at 1136.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Rico from Boulder, Colorado wants to know, Dear Dr. Science, why are telephone keypads in numeric ascending order left to right and calculator keypads in descending order right to left? Is there a logical explanation here? Wouldn't it be easier on all of us, particularly the blind, if they were the same?
Sure, it'd be easier, but that's not the American way.